Ari and Navita, the Mahasatsakas, are done. Mahimarika is very sensitive and continue to see what it has to say. And this is what happens next. So he's just now thinking this will serve driving. Yeah, this is, in other words, this is right for someone who is going to look for an awakening. That's really what it means. So it has a delightful place. And now he talks about what happens after this. Now, these three similes occur to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light the fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could that man light the fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying in the water? No. You know what they mean by upper fire stick? You know what this is all about? Yeah, exactly, that's right, yeah. But the ancient way of producing fire, you have two pieces of wood, and one was kind of sitting there, and the other one was a round stick, and it would go like this, and it would cause huge friction between the pieces of wood, and it would create fire that way. Yeah. There had to be a special type of wood to be able to create fire this way. Yeah. The ancient way of producing fire. Of course, if it is wet, there's no chance. That's pretty obvious. No, Master Gautama.
Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, and it is lying in water. Eventually that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesanaha, as to those recluses and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feeling due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertions, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. So here, the wet and sappy piece of wood lying in the water, this is like a person who is full of kind of desires for sensual pleasures. You are wet and sappy means that you have all these things inside of you, you're thinking about them and all these kind of things. And the fact that you're lying in the water means that you are still kind of living that kind of life. Yeah, you're living in the city and all of these things are around you all the time. So this is what this is about. If these things are around you all the time and you're full of these desires yourself, then it is impossible to reach awakening, says the Buddha, regardless of any ascetic practice. Ascetic practices are beside the point, he says here. Yeah? You do it or don't do it, doesn't make any difference. It doesn't work. And now you can sort of start to imagine what is going to happen in the next things, the next kind of two similes here. Again, Agivesana, a second simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land, far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? No, Master Gautama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, even though it is lying on dry land far from water. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesana, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures. In other words, you have left the city, yeah? You're living somewhere in the forest or something like that. But whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel those things, they are still incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was the second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. So this is interesting. So now the person has withdrawn from the sensual pleasures of the world, but they're still thinking about them, and they're still occupied with these things. It is still important to them, yeah? And still, then, it is impossible to reach awakening because of that. And this is, it ties in, of course, with the five hindrances. Yeah, the idea of the five hindrances on the Buddhist path. We have to overcome the hindrances to be able to have real insight and to be able to have real samadhi on this path. Only when the hindrances are abandoned is it actually possible to have insight and samadhi. Before that, awakening is impossible. And the Buddha had insight into this even before his awakening, yeah, before he actually understands the Dhamma fully. So this is why overcoming the hindrances is such an important part, such an important aspect of meditation practice. I will talk about these things so much, and I will talk more about this also later on, how to deal with these things. So that is the first point there. Yeah, the other point which is interesting is that in this case, the Brahmins or the monks or whoever they are, they have withdrawn to the forest, but it's not enough to withdraw to the forest. If you still kind of hang out in your mind in the realm of sensual pleasures, well, it's not gonna work. So going to the forest is only one part of it. Yeah, staying in the forest monastery is only one aspect of it. This does not mean, however, that staying in the forest monastery is kind of optional. Yeah, it doesn't matter as long as you don't think about sensuality. It doesn't matter whether you live in the forest or the city. Because as the third simile we point out, the third simile is about having bodily withdrawn and mentally withdrawn. There is no category where you have bodily not withdrawn, but you have mentally withdrawn. It always, first of all, you have the kaya viveka. From the kaya viveka comes the chitta viveka. Kaya viveka means seclusion of the body. After you have the seclusion of the body, then you get the seclusion of the mind. Seclusion from what? Seclusion from the hindrances, from especially from sensuality itself. So kaya viveka is always the first step. So, you know, this is what you will find as well. When you go to a meditation center far away, it's easier to feel peaceful. It's easier to get good meditation because the environment is right. And one of the things I was reading out here last year, I think, because last year we had so many hours, can almost read the whole Pali Canon, we had so many hours last year. Not quite, but you know what I mean. So, and one of the things I was reading out was the Digha Nikaya 16, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, a large section of that. And one of the beautiful things it says in the beginning of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it says, talks about the seven factors of non-decline. Yeah, the Apparihana Dhamma. These seven factors are when the Buddha says in the future, yeah, to make sure that the Dhamma doesn't decline, this is what you have to do. So very interesting, very important things. What are these seven things the Buddha is talking about that we should be, how we should live to ensure, especially as bhikkhus, this is a teaching given to the bhikkhus and probably the bhikkhunis as well, specific, not so much to lay people. What are these seven things? One of those seven things that I like to point out, and it fits in perfectly what the Buddha is saying here, you should live in forest lodgings. As long as the monks and nuns, it actually only says monks in this particular sutta, but as long as the monastics enjoy and are dedicated to forest lodgings, so long you can expect the Dhamma to increase Buddha and not decline. Yeah, so forest lodgings is so important, it is so incredibly significant. It doesn't matter, it doesn't mean that if you are a forest, a city monk, you are bad. It doesn't mean that. But if you really want to be able to improve your meditation, if you want to achieve the deep states of samadhi, exactly what these similes are saying, first you withdraw bodily into the forest, then you withdraw mentally. There's a natural sequence here. And it is, in fact, so important that the entire future of Buddhism depends on it. How is that possible? How can the entire future of Buddhism depend on monks living in the forest or not? Well, the reason is because if that's where you get your good meditation, that is also where you get your insights. That's where you get your understanding of the Dhamma. That is, and people having a direct personal experience of the Dhamma, that is what enables Buddhism to thrive. Yeah? If everybody's just reading books and coming from the books, then there's no, it has lost its reality. The reality comes from personal experience. The reality is when you look at someone and you say, yeah, this person, they are really inspiring, they are different, they have something that I haven't got. Yeah, you can tell just by looking at them that they are different. You know, people like Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm, many of the other famous forest monks who were very special. You think, wow, this is it. And then that's where your faith really becomes strong and your confidence becomes strong, because the learning you have from the books and the reality that you see matches perfectly. If you only have the learning from the books, it's like only having one side, and you're missing seeing the living example. And for that reason, it's almost as if the Dhamma is dead at that particular point. So this is why forest lodging is so important. Yeah. So if you have any forest lodging monks in Malaysia, Agacitta, he has quite, his monastery is a bit like a forest monastery up in Taiping. Have you been up there? Yeah, this monastery? Yeah, yeah. So Venerable Agacitta, I've been up there as well. It's actually a nice monastery, and the kind of very steep monastery in the hill there behind the city. And that is one of the forest monasteries here. I haven't been to Bhikkhu Hai's monastery. Have you been to Bhikkhu Hai's monastery in Tamabudo? Yeah? Is that like a forest monastery as well? Or on the edge? Kind of on the edge? Yeah, yeah. So support those monastics who live well in Malaysia, yeah? Because that is where you're more likely to get monastics who have these have the right kind of insights. So that's kind of the most important thing here. Anyway, that's a little bit of a sidetrack, but it's so fascinating that the Buddha says actually the future of Buddhism depends on this, yeah. And this, of course, is why the forest tradition, generally speaking, has been very well supported around the world over the centuries and millennia, because people realized that this was actually in accordance with how the Buddha said we should be doing things. So let's come to the last simile. Again, Agivesana. A third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could that man light a fire and produce heat by rubbing it against a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because it is a dry, sapless piece of wood, and it is lying on dry land far from water. So too, Agivesana. As to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasure, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures have been fully abandoned and suppressed internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. This was the third simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. These are the three similes that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. So there you are, bodily and mentally withdrawn, kaya viveka, citta viveka, that is the path to awakening here. You can see now that he's starting to understand, yeah, where awakening lies and where it does not lie here. And here he has kind of found one of the extremes is dangerous, the extreme of sensual pleasures, but he hasn't yet fully understood the extreme of tormenting the body. And that is why he says, you know, whether you torture the body or not, it's not going to make a difference, you're still going to be able to find awakening here. But actually, as we shall see later on, he changes his mind on that, and he looks at things in a different way here. So, next comes the ascetic practices. Yeah, the way the Buddha undertook the ascetic practices before he finally understood the path, the middle way. And it is interesting, where does the Buddha get these ideas from, the ascetic practices? And obviously, where he gets it from the Indian ascetic culture at that time. This was very much part of the Indian culture. If you were an ascetic, you're supposed to do ascetic practices. You already had the Jains, yeah? The Jains were already kind of practicing ascetic practices. Quite possibly the Buddha was trained under the Jains. Maybe the Buddha was a bit like a Jain for a while before he decided that that path doesn't work. It is one of those things. It seems to be so common in human history here, where that people think that by doing self-mortification, by torturing the body, somehow we're going to be able to release the mind from sensual pleasures. I think the idea is that you understand the danger of sensual pleasures, and you think, if I do the exact opposite, instead of indulging, I will torment myself, and maybe that is kind of counteracting the sensuality, yeah? So if I indulge is one thing, but if I counteract it by torturing myself, maybe that is kind of the way to go, so that I, you know, you're kind of counteracting that. You can kind of see a logic in that, yeah? One thing counteracts the other. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually turn out to be correct. And so many religions around the world have exactly this kind of view. You certainly have it in Hinduism. You also have it in parts of Christianity, the idea that you're kind of supposed to flog yourself and stand on the pillar for 20 years or whatever, yeah. And apparently in Islam also you have a kind of a part of it which is all about torturing yourself and all these kind of things. It seems to be a very common religious theme in humanity that we think self-torture is the path forward if you want to kind of liberate the mind or liberate the spirit from the evil desires, yeah, the bad desires that kind of bind you to samsara and bind you to worldly existence. Because it is such a deep-seated thing in human beings, it means that it's very easy to lean that way. And this is probably why the Buddha-to-be, he is now leaning in that direction. He's going to try out everything that ancient India has to offer in terms of spiritual practice before eventually he finds his own way. So the Buddha-to-be also going down that path. So let's see what he does. What actually happens when he practices this ascetic practices. I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain and crush mind with mind. So with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits, just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head and shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him. So too, with teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, an unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So here the Buddha to be is trying to control his mind directly with his mind, using the mind to beat down the mind. Yeah, and I don't know, you may have seen this passage elsewhere. This passage also occurs in a sutta called the Vitakka Santana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 20, the overcoming or the calming of thoughts. Yeah, it occurs in there. And that sutta is very nice. I will read it out later on during the meditation retreat later on. It's all about how to overcome unwholesome thoughts. Yeah, let's say you get angry. How do you overcome that anger? And that sutta gives you five ways, graded one thing after the other, how to overcome anger and ill will. And it starts off very beautifully, from very beautiful things in there, how to overcome anger and ill will. Incredibly useful. This is number one problem for a lot of people. And even for those not number one problem, it's still a problem for all of us to some extent. It's very rare to find someone who is never angry, except if you're an arahant perhaps. And so, what are those five ways? And in brief, the first one is to learn how to look at people, to kind of substitute the thought and to learn to understand the disadvantages of these thoughts and to allow them to subside by themselves and these kind of things. But the last one of these five ways is exactly this one. Yeah, in there it says you constrain mind with mind, crush mind with mind. So on the one hand here, it doesn't lead forward on the path. It doesn't lead him to the goal. But on the other hand, the Buddha actually does say this is a way to be used in meditation practice. If you have really have a problem with anger and you cannot use the earlier methods about thinking wisely and being smart about it, there comes a point when you have to crush mind with mind to overcome the anger. But it is the very last way. It is the very, when everything else fails, that is when you use willpower to crush mind with mind. But it's not the first thing to do. Most people tend to kind of suppress things. First thing they do is suppress, crush mind with mind. But that actually is the wrong way, according to the Buddha. The first way is more to use wisdom power to overcome anger. If the wisdom power fails and you are about to murder someone, that is when you crush mind with mind. So if you feel the murderous instinct arising in you, if you can feel the murder arising inside of you, the inner murderer is coming out, that is the time to say, crush mind with mind, cleanse your teeth. I'm not going to do that. This happens sometimes. Sometimes you kind of fantasize, I want to kill this person. I had absolutely enough. There was a nice study done in the United States many years ago, one of the universities, and they asked the students, how many of you had a fantasy about killing someone in the last week, or I can't remember if it was the last week or last year or whatever. And 90% of the students had a fantasy about killing someone. So this is how murder, if a fantasy keeps on growing, eventually you end up killing somebody. So it's a very common human thing, this idea. Sometimes we get so angry, we actually, the idea arises in our head. And this can be problematic as a consequence. So it is part of the path, sometimes in desperate circumstances, but it is not a means to awakening in its own right. This is what the Buddha is saying here. If it is used at the right time, occasionally, then it's okay, but it's not a method to actually get you to awakening. It doesn't work. It's only a temporary measure to get out of a desperate situation when you're about to do something really, really bad, and you know, okay, I have to stop myself. Okay, so he's really practicing hard. Yes, sweat ran from my armpits. Talk about really crushing mind with mind. He doesn't mess around. He was kind of really doing everything he possibly could. Tireless energy was aroused. In other words, he didn't allow his energy to disappear. Energy here is the natural energy of the mind. Yeah. Unremitting mindfulness, that means constant mindfulness. But the body was not tranquil, and tranquility of the body is one of the factors required for samadhi to become possible. So he was far away from samadhi. This is one of the things that he is saying here. Because of the painful striving, he was exhausted by the painful striving. The striving, the pain in itself, is actually leading in the wrong direction here. And then last thing he's talking about here, he didn't allow the pain to invade his mind. That is part of the broader context of the sutta when he's talking to Agivesana. So I'm not going to worry too much about that. And then that is the first kind of ascetic practice that he did, crushing mind with mind. Then we come to the second kind of ascetic practice. And this is as follows. I thought, suppose I practice the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth and nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. just as though a loud sound when the smith's bellows are blown, so too, while I stopped the in-breath and out-breath through my nose and ears, there was a loud sound of wind coming out from my ears. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So here we have the breathless meditation. The Pali word for the breathless meditation is the apanaka jhana. Yeah, so here it is called jhana. And usually in the suttas, the jhana only has one meaning, and it means like the very deep states of meditation. Here it is referring to something else. Here it refers to stopping the breath. It's almost got nothing to do with meditation whatsoever. It's only got to do with stopping your breath. And this is what I was saying before. In India, before the Buddha's awakening, there was already an established vocabulary for ascetics and Brahmins for how to lead the spiritual life. And jhana was one such word, and it was used quite broadly to mean, it seems here, almost to mean like any kind of practice, yeah, that is kind of driving you towards awakening. Here it was referred specifically to some kind of breath control, almost, what it's referring to here. So again, important to remember this idea that the vocabulary change that happened at this particular time. But later on in the suttas, jhana always means the same thing. It means the four jhanas, the samma samadhi, the factors on the Noble Eightfold Path. Here, apanaka jhana is something completely different. It doesn't refer to the jhanas at all. And he stops his inbreathing, yeah, through the mouth and nose. And then you have the winds coming out of the ears. It's a bit scary, isn't it? Imagine that happening. What does that mean? It must mean that he probably has blown his eardrums. Yeah? It must mean that he'd blown his eardrums and suddenly he can breathe through his ears instead. It must be kind of scary if you're breathing through your ears. Let me try. I'm not sure if I would. That would sound really kind of. This is what it means, that he really goes. He really takes it all the way, yeah? He doesn't mess around. Goes to the point where he starts breathing through his ears. I never even heard of anyone breathing through their ears before, until you read the suttas. That's what you hear about breathing through your ears. So this is the Buddha to be. He's really serious about his spiritual practice. And then we have a number of stages of the breathless meditation, yeah? So that I'm not going to read them all, because they are basically just variations on the same theme. In the next one, he stops the breath through his mouth, nose, and ears. Yeah, doesn't breathe through the ears either. So he stops his ears and maybe puts a plug in his ear or something. But then other things start to happen. You get really sharp pains happening because you stop your breathing for so long. And all of this is what is happening in the next few paragraphs here. I'm not going to read it all out because it is quite repetitive. It just shows you how he takes this to the maximum. And then on page 12, paragraph 3 is the third one where he talks about this. So he stops again the breath through the mouth, nose and ears. And this time he feels a violent burning in my body. Yeah, just as if two strong men were seized a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. So too, I felt a violent burning in my body. Again, the painful feeling was not invade his mind and remain. So, it's hard to imagine doing this. It's so over the top, yeah? It's hard to really understand. I mean, he really takes these ascetic practices to an absolute extreme. Then comes a little interlude, this little paragraph here. Now when the deities saw me, some said, the recluse Gotama is dead. Yeah. Other deities said, the recluse Gotama is not dead, but he is dying. And other deities said, the recluse Gotama is not dead nor dying. He is an arahant, for such is the way that the arahants abide. Had very different opinions. And so obviously the Buddha, he must have kind of, you know, he must have taken this to the point where he almost died, basically. Otherwise, why would this Devas go and say that he's dead? Yeah, but on the other hand, so other deities, you know, one of the Jain ways of living is that you fast at the very end, you fast until you die. Yeah, that is a kind of the Jain kind of idea of the Arahant, the fully awakened Jain ascetic. And here the Buddha is probably something similar kind of idea. If you take these ascetic practices to the extreme, that is how you become an Arahant according to those days. And that's why the deities would say that. Oh, this is the way, yeah, you're doing well. And that's why they're kind of chilling in the heavenly realm, yeah, drinking, eating, having a good time. Yeah, look at these Arahants. And they're kind of, it's a bit almost hypocritical, you know. And the Devas are so happy up there. And here you see the word Arahant again. In the Buddhist teaching, Arahant always means a fully awakened being. Here it is used again in the pre-Buddhist sense. Yeah, Arahant just means someone here who is, they don't really know what it means. It means some spiritual saint, but nobody really knows what it means at this particular point. It's a general word used in that ancient Indian society at that time, even used by the Devas in this particular case. So, I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food. Then the deities came to me and said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and you will live on that. I considered, if I claim to be completely fasting, while these deities infuse heavenly food into the pores of my skin, and I live on that, then I shall be lying. So I dismissed those deities, saying, there is no need. It's kind of curious, isn't it? A curious little paragraph. And you wonder whether this actually happened. Do these things happen? Do you ever have deities coming to you and saying, we will infuse food through your skin? It's not a common thing, yeah? It's not something that happens to every person around us. So it makes you wonder whether this... Of course, the Buddha was very special, so perhaps it happened to the Buddha. It's very hard to know. I must admit, I'm a little bit skeptical. I would wonder what it actually says in the parallel sutta. This sutta has... There's no parallel in Chinese, but there's a parallel in Sanskrit. But it hasn't really been translated yet properly, and there is no, even the Sanskrit version, it hasn't been made available to the public. It is still being restored by these kind of, people who restore ancient suttas, and it's taking for ages to restore them. Been going now for a couple of decades already, still hasn't been released to the general public. But eventually, hopefully, this sutta will be released. This is an interesting thing about the suttas. You may wonder, why doesn't this sutta exist in the Chinese translation? Yeah. Does that mean it is a dodgy sutta if it doesn't exist in Chinese? Not necessarily. And the reason for that is because in the Chinese translation we have two of the agamas, which are like the Nikayas. Yeah. One of the agamas is the Madhyama agama, which is the same as the Majjhima Nikaya. That exists, it comes from the Sarvastivadin school. You have the Sangyukta Agama, which is similar to the Sangyutta Nikaya, also comes from the Sarvastivadin school. But the Dirga Agama, which is like the Diga Nikaya, it doesn't come from the Sarvastivadin, it comes from the Dhammaguptaka school in the Chinese translation. The Chinese Agamas are not united according to school in the same way as the Pali is. The Pali is united, everything is from Theravada. In the Agamas, they come from different schools. So because of that, when we compare them, we're not comparing like with like. So let's, for example, say that this particular sutta, yeah, the Majjhima Nikaya 36, the Mahasatchika Sutta, let's say that in the Sarvastivadin school, maybe it was transmitted in the Dirga Agama. Yeah, in the Pali, it is transmitted in the Majjhima Nikaya, but perhaps in the Sarvastivadin, it was transmitted in the Dirga Agama. Because we don't have the Sarvastivadin Dirga Agama, we wouldn't know about it if it existed in the Dirga Agama. The Dharmaguptaka school may have transmitted it in the Majjhima Agama. But because we don't have the Majjhima Agama of the Dharmaguptaka, we don't know it. if it exists in the Dharmaguptaka school. Huh? So in this way, it may look as if it wasn't transmitted in the Chinese. It may look as if the sutta is missing from the Sarvastivadins in the Dharmaguptakas, but it depends entirely on which collection this sutta was transmitted in. And what is interesting is that, as I was just saying, the ancient Dirga Agama of the Sarvastivadins, just excuse me for 1 second. The ancient Dirga Agama of the Sarvastivadin school was discovered in some kind of, you know, in Afghanistan somewhere about 20 years ago or 15 years ago. It was sold by some kind of dodgy dealer in Afghanistan. You can imagine, in Afghanistan, it's basically a Muslim country, and then they find these ancient urns in the sand, yeah, and they kind of open them up, and they find these ancient manuscripts inside, and they haven't got a clue what it is. They can't read it. It's in a language they can't read in Afghanistan, but they've probably figured this might be valuable, yeah, this looks really valuable, looks really ancient, so take it to some kind of antique shop in Kabul somewhere in Afghanistan, and they put them on the shelf, hoping that some kind of ancient manuscript collector will come by and say, wow, look at these manuscripts, I want to pay a fortune for these things, yeah? And this is how they kind of made their way, and then they were sold from Afghanistan to London. Some kind of collector in London bought them, and he put them in a shop in London, and eventually someone who understood what this was got hold of these manuscripts. Strange how these things kind of, you know, suddenly appear out of nowhere. They've been sitting in the desert in Afghanistan for 1,500 years. But because the climate is so dry, because the climate is so suitable for the conservation of manuscripts, they can sit in the desert for 1,500 years, you take them out, and you can read them pretty much straight away, because the quality is so good. And then it turns out that these manuscripts are the Sarvastivadin Dirga Agama. Yeah. I think for these Afghanis who tried to read this, you can imagine they did know up and down, yeah, or this manuscript. But it turns out to be that. And what do you find in the Sarvastivadin Dirga? You find this sutta. Yeah, it's there. So what it means is that the reason why it hasn't been translated into Chinese is precisely what I was saying before. Because in the Sarvastivadin school, it was transmitted in the Dirga Agama, not in the Majjhima, where it was transmitted in the Pali. That's why it doesn't exist in the Chinese. In Chinese, you have a Dharmaguptaka Dirga, which is of another school, and they may have transmitted it in the Majjhima. So this is how we have to be careful sometimes. But it was very exciting when that manuscript eventually gets published. This is what monks get excited by, yeah? When that manuscript gets published, to compare it and to see the difference between the Pali and the Sarvastivadin. We're very interested to see that. And I wonder whether this passage is in there or not. My guess is there's a good chance it is not in there, because it is a little bit curious. The supernatural passages in the suttas tend to be the ones that vary the most across the traditions. The down-to-earth stuff, yeah? Be kind, be generous. That is the same everywhere. When the kind of devas are flying through the air and the Buddha is performing supernormal powers, you can be pretty sure it is unreliable and of origin, because the Buddha doesn't talk like that. Even if it may be the case that Buddha could do these things, he doesn't actually do it usually. Hope I don't disappoint you with that. People like supernatural stuff, yeah. Wow, flying through the air, walking through the walls, that kind of stuff. But it's just entertainment, yeah, let's face it. That's all it is, entertainment. It doesn't mean anything. Do we have enough entertainment already, yeah, with your iPhones and everything? So forget about that. Okay. So, now he's going to practice the ascetic practices. And this is very close, of course, to the Jain practice in ancient India, doing ascetic practices. The Buddha stops the infusion of heavenly food. Of course, he has integrity, of course. He doesn't want to kind of lie or to be kind of doing things in a dodgy way. He is serious about his spiritual pursuit. He's not going to do things halfway. So he dismisses those deities. And this is also kind of the one of the points here may also simply be to show that the Buddha, even the Buddha to be, before his awakening, already he has more insight than the deities. Already he is smarter than these gods. Yeah, just because you're a god doesn't mean you understand very much. You may be more happy. Yeah, you got a few extra powers, but actually your wisdom isn't all that great. Yeah, kind of hanging out and then being a little bit stupid. So this is what happens as the Buddha gets into this. I thought, suppose I take very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. So I took very little food, a handful each time of these kinds of soup. While I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. You can imagine what the Buddha to be looked like at this particular point. Really, really thin. I'm sure you have maybe seen those statues, of the Buddha that they have, of the Buddha was practicing the ascetic practices. They sometimes have these statues. People call it the Buddha statue. It's not actually a Buddha statue because it wasn't a Buddha yet. So don't think it was like, it's a statue of the Buddha to be, and he still has wrong view. So we shouldn't really worship those statues because they're actually, the Buddha hasn't really got it yet. So those statues can be there as a reminder of wrong view rather than a reminder of the real Buddha. This is the real Buddha up here, and those other ones are actually the wrong view Buddha to be here. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. Not entirely sure what that refers to be honest, but I guess the idea is that the brightness of the eye or something like that, the eyes sinking in or the brightness, something is going on there. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. I've never seen anyone so thin before. Thus, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. If I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Jeepers. Because of eating so little, if I defecated or urinated, I fell over on my face right there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots fell from my body as I rubbed. So it's pretty severe, yeah? It's almost hard to imagine how this is possible. But obviously he's taking it to the absolute extreme. And because he is obviously a very strong person, got a very strong mind, he's able to keep alive. Most of us probably have been dead a long time ago, yeah? With this kind of thing, you probably wouldn't think it'd be worthwhile living anymore. But because the Buddha is searching, aiming for the highest kind of goal, for him, obviously, it is worthwhile living because he's searching for something very profound. So in that case, he keeps himself going. But he's taking the ascetic practices to an absolute extreme. One of the things I like about the suttas, and I don't know what you think about this, but things like he says here, because of eating so little, if I defecate and urinated, I fell over on my face right there. It is so natural. Yeah, the Buddha doesn't shy away talking about the body and its natural functions, the way it works. He talks about these things. And I think one of the reasons why the Buddha to be, talks about this is because it humanizes the Buddha. It makes him just like everyone else. Yeah, what you're seeing here is the humanity of the Buddha in very clear profile. Not just here, but this kind of language is also used elsewhere. The Buddha talks about, you know, very similar to this, but also about his body when it ages and he has a back pain and all of these kind of things. It brings out the humanity of the Buddha. It reminds us that in a sense he is one of us. He's not different from us. He's not some kind of, Dhamma body or whatever it is. He's part of humanity in a sense. So very natural, but it's almost like difficult to read sometimes, because sometimes you want to put the Buddha on a pedestal. It's hard to imagine him like an ordinary human being like that. You rather read about those mythology and legends. Yeah, oh yeah, I can do that. That is kind of, that seems right. Yeah, he is kind of all the superpowers. That's kind of what you want to read about. You don't want to read about all this ordinary human stuff. But I think that's precisely the point. The Buddha does that precisely to remind us that this is the nature of the human body, regardless of who you are. And we and him, we are essentially the same. Okay. Now, when people saw me, some said, the recluse Gotama is black. Other people said, the recluse Gotama is not black, he is brown. Other people said, the recluse Gotama is neither black nor brown, he is golden skinned. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. So, of course, being black in India is a bad thing. Yeah, the blacker you are, the worse it is. The Brahmins are always said to be the ones with bright skin. Yeah, the ones who are kind of, they are, look as white as possible. The whiter you are, the better it is. And it's a bit like cultures around the world. It's everywhere. It is the same pretty much. Yeah, whiteness is a good thing. In India, exactly the same thing. So when the Buddha became black here, again, it shows that he didn't really care about such stupid things about skin color. Who cares about that? What matters is the spiritual pursuit. And now he kind of probably imagine what he looked like, completely black, yeah? Everything was so thin, he could touch his kind of backbone through his belly. He must have looked terrible at this particular point, yeah? Kind of like a complete outcast. And people probably saw him and kind of thought, okay, you know, what is this guy up to? And you can see how that would have been looked down upon very strongly in Indian society. One of the little interesting things that show you how bad kind of darkness and blackness was considered in India, you know, Krishna, the Hindu god, yeah, Krishna. Now, when you see a picture of Krishna, you know what color Krishna is? Blue, exactly. Blue, yeah, Krishna is always painted blue. But actually, the word Krishna actually means black. Yeah, so it's very likely that the god Krishna, the original color was black, but in India that was so bad to be black. Let's make him blue instead. Blue, much better than black, yeah? So make him blue. That's how Krishna became blue. So the Krishna actually means the black one. But how can you have a god who's the black one? Okay, blue. So that's how things work out. So, that is what happened there. So then, now comes the really interesting part, yeah? The Buddha to be thought. I thought, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is nothing beyond this. And whatever recluses, Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion. This is the utmost. There is nothing beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is nothing beyond this. So, in other words, he has taken the ascetic practices to an extreme. He has almost died, gone to death's door, yeah, where the deva said that he was dead already. And beyond that, there's only one thing, and that is death. The human body can only take so much. Comes a point when the human body gives up and you just die. And he has tried the breathless meditations, the not eating, and the first one, crushing mind with mind, three types of ascetic practices that he practiced. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman state, uttari manusadhamma, superhuman quality, if you like, supernormal qualities, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to awakening? Any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? Yeah, the Aryas. He doesn't really know Aryas yet, so this is probably just the Buddha thinking back. When he's thinking back, he uses the word noble ones. At that time, he wouldn't have known about this already. Could there be another path to awakening? So what we have seen so far is the Buddha has rejected sensual pleasures as being impossible, being incompatible with awakening. The dry piece of wood has to be taken long way from the river to dry out. That's one extreme. He has now tried the other extreme, the self-mortification, the torment of the body, taken that as far as it possibly can. That doesn't work, yeah? Is there another way to awakening, is the question he has now. I recall that when my father the Sakyan was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded, fully secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states or unwholesome qualities, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to awakening? Yeah? The jhanas have got nothing to do with sensuality, got nothing to do with torment of the body. Maybe that is the path to awakening. Then following on that memory came the realization that is indeed the path to awakening. So this is that discovery of the middle path, yeah? The jhanas here stand in for the middle path, because the jhanas is the highest expression of the Noble Eightfold Path. If you practice the Noble Eightfold Path all the way to the end, that is exactly where it gets you. So the jhanas really summarize the idea of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is such a powerful statement in the suttas. Yeah? The Buddha is trying to find awakening, and the awakening is to be found in the jhanas. And even today, there are still people claiming that jhanas aren't required on this path. And yet, this is the Buddha's very discovery, that samadhi and jhana is required if you want to attain this awakening. It is absolutely crucial, yeah, it's a fundamental element to the Buddha's discovery of the path, that he saw the necessity of jhana for the practice. And the reason is precisely because it neither is self-torment nor is it indulgence. It is an alternative way of looking at the world, an alternative way of dealing with reality. I'm not going to go so much into that formula, but of course the important point here, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from the senses, yeah? Secluded from unwholesome states, the five hindrances. This is kind of the critical aspect there. You go into this first jhana experience. Then I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome qualities? I thought, I am not afraid of that pleasure, since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome qualities. I considered, it is not easy to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. And I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. Now at that time, the five monks were waiting upon me, thinking, if our recluse Gotama achieves some higher quality, he will inform us. But when I ate the boiled rice and porridge, the five bhikkhus were disgusted and left me, thinking, The recluse Gautama now lives luxuriously. He has given up his striving and reverted to luxury. Yeah? This is one of the problems with being a revolutionary. This is the problem with being someone who bucks the trend and goes your own way. If you go your own way, society by and large will reject you. At that time, ascetic practices was the norm. Everybody did ascetic practices, except for maybe Alara Kalama and Uddha Karanaputta. But this was the norm in Indian society. And if you started eating, if you started doing that thing that went against that norm, you would normally be rejected as not being a true ascetic, not being a true recluse. So this is a danger for the Buddha to be as well. Yeah, once this happens, people won't take him seriously anymore. Even his five companions, who obviously knew him very well, even they rejected him at this point, even though they must have known about his all his other incredibly good qualities, still they reject him, because he dares to go against the norm of society. But this is also the hallmark of a true genius. The hallmark of a true genius is that you are willing and able to go against the crowd. You go your own way, you do things differently. Yeah, this is what, if you really want to break the habits of the world, you want to see things in a new way, you cannot just do what everyone else does, because you're never going to get anything at all. You're just going to be like everyone else. You have to find your own way to some extent. So sometimes when people do this, it is actually very worthwhile and very beautiful when people do dare to challenge the prevailing views and go their own way. Because sometimes it is necessary. It is the only way to achieve something higher and more beautiful. And this is what is happening with the Buddha to be in this case. So again, here you can start to see the middle way. Yeah, you have to eat. That's one of the aspects of the middle way. Eating is included in the middle way. So fasting too much doesn't actually work according to the middle way. Yeah, so eating is okay. Don't have to fast too much. It's good. It's nice, isn't it? It means that you don't have to worry so much. Sometimes people get into fasting a lot, but actually it's not really part of the Buddhist path to fast. Just the right amount of food is the Buddhist path. Not too much so that you kind of fall asleep, and not too little so that you feel weak or whatever from under-eating. Just the middle way in food, where it's just nice and sufficient to keep you going and practicing. Yeah, that is the right thing. That is what the Buddha is starting to realize here. Of course, this is all also where that famous story of Sujata comes in, yeah? Sujata with the milk rice is not actually found in the suttas, but this presumably was, according to the later commentary, this would have been Sujata who then came with the boiled porridge, yeah? Here you are. And then she was so happy because of that, offering to the Buddha. Imagine offering the last meal to the Buddha before awakening, yeah? It would be something incredibly powerful to do that. Sorry? No. This is actually not in the sutta. This is a later thing. There's nothing about poor old Sujata in the sutta. So it's more like legend, I think. Because very often what happens, you get the bare bones in the suttas. The Buddha took some food, and then people start, but who gave that food? Yeah, we want to know who gave it. Let me think. Yeah, I think there was a woman called, wasn't there a woman called Sujata? Yeah, I think so. Okay, better write it down. That's how the commentaries arise, yeah? This is how they arise. So the commentary is uncertain. So, just finish off the last, very last thing here. Now, when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, then, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, I did enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And this is when the Buddha starts to practice those things that are suitable and possible for the awakening to occur. He has found, he has discovered the middle way. The middle way, the essence of the middle way is the jhanas. Because the jhanas happen when you separate yourself from the sensual world and you separate yourself from all the hindrances and problems. You don't torment the body. That is where the jhanas exist. When you find the ease, the comfort, the relaxation, that is where they become possible. The Buddha has discovered the middle way, and then he practiced that middle way himself, and later on, of course, he reaches the full awakening experience based on that middle way. So, enough for now. Let us have a short break, some tea and things. We have shortened everything down today a little bit. So we're going to have only half an hour tea break and half an hour meditation and then an hour Q&A afterwards. So everyone gets to get to go back home an hour earlier. So I hope you are pleased with the new program. And if you're not pleased with it, then what then, Bobby? Tough luck? Is that what we say then? Or I'm not sure. Anyway, we'll see you back in half an hour.